The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
We are following breaking news. U.S. military forces shot down a second object over U.S. airspace earlier today.
This comes less than 1 week after the Biden administration ordered a Chinese spy balloon to be shot down. National Security Council Coordinator for Strategic Communications John Kirby announced today the Department of Defense had been tracking a high-altitude object flying over Alaska.
Russia's Deputy Prime Minister and Oil Minister Alexander Novak saying the country will cut oil output by 500,000 barrels per day starting next month. The move comes after Western nations imposed sanctions against Russian energy. There are also signs that Russia is starting to feel the pain of the sanctions, with the country's revenue from oil and gas dropping nearly 50% in January compared to 2022.
We hear these job numbers, we all celebrate because we want people to have jobs, but the Fed doesn't look at it that way.
Right. Yeah, the Fed is not happy to see the unemployment rate at 3.4%. And this is when you see good news becoming bad news, right? Because right now, we have inflation. It's come down quite a bit. We are seeing it take a leg lower almost every single month, but it's still far from that 2% target rate that the Fed has. And just this week, which is why we saw losses earlier in the week in the markets, Fed officials came out and said, we're not done yet. If you honestly thought that we were going to stop raising interest rates, you've got another thing coming. You can expect to see those interest rates keep going higher.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
This week, stocks took a break from the momentum charge in January following the steep jobs report just last week. The catalyst this week were Fed Chair Powell's conversations with David Rubenstein at the Economic Club, President Biden's State of the Union address, discussions about AI following Microsoft's purchase of OpenAI, and an announcement by Russia it plans to cut production in March. Otherwise, it wasn't a real eventful week outside of those key issues as investors continue to evaluate what the new jobs data means for inflation and what to do with rising valuations as earnings fall. Initially on Tuesday, during Fed Chair Powell's conversations with David Rubenstein, it saw the main indices spike higher with a relatively calm demeanor when asked about the latest jobs report. Investors were concerned if the data had changed the Fed's thinking at all, because it had changed the Fed futures probabilities based on, if you look at the CME FedWatch tool, which saw probability of a third hike this year go from 30% from the jobs data last Thursday to north of 70% on the following Monday. The market fell drastically after Powell said the Fed will react to the incoming data and will do more rate hikes if the data suggests it's necessary. The S&P 500 fell to 4,100, slightly below, where buyers came in to buy the dip and help close the main indices up for the day by 2.1% for the NASDAQ and 1.4% for the S&P 500. The announcement by Microsoft that AI would assist in its Bing and Edge browsers was a big boost to AI and momentum stocks on Tuesday. Chairman and CEO Satya Nadella said, "We're launching Bing and Edge powered by AI Copilot and chat to help people get more from search and the web." Microsoft had said half of its 10 billion searches a day go unanswered because today people ask of the search engine to do things it wasn't originally designed to do. Now, with the help of AI search engines, we'll be able to answer more complex questions. The announcement has made Google look a bit behind in the AI department, and the stock has recently suffered this week, down 9.8%. Those concerns weren't alleviated when the company launched Bard AI at an event and it answered a question incorrectly. Secondly, this week, President Biden's State of the Union address asked Congress to consider a billionaire minimum tax, quadrupling of the tax on corporate stock buybacks, and raising the debt limit without conditions. He also suggested there needs to be tighter antitrust regulations of the technology sector. And recently, the UK had expressed concerns over the Microsoft and Activision deal. For now, investors didn't seem overly concerned with the response Wednesday, but emergency treasury measures will only last so long as it relates to the debt ceiling. Investors will want to see that get resolved eventually, as Fed Chair Powell and U.S. Secretary Yellen have both voiced their dire concerns if the U.S. were to default on debt. Finally, oil rose 8.6% this week as Russia announced a cut in production of about 500,000 barrels a day starting in March. The energy sector was the only positive sector for the week, up 4.9%, and the worst sector was the communications sector for the week, down 5.6%, helped by that weakness I mentioned in Alphabet, down 9.8%, Pinterest was down 9.6%, Meta was down 6.6%, and Netflix was down 5% on the week. On the economic front, the unemployment claims report increased 13,000 to 196,000, still showing well below levels typically seen, and showing essentially a tightness in the labor market and a reluctance that companies are showing to cut employees. The Friday University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Report ticked higher, but inside the report showed year-ahead inflation expectations bumped higher to 4.2% from 3.9% this week. The 10-year Treasury yield rose 21 basis points through the week, up to 3.74% on rising concerns that the Fed may not be ready to pause around that March corner. Next week, more on the inflation front with the Consumer Price Index report Tuesday, Producer Price Index Thursday, retail sales Wednesday, housing data, manufacturing data for February with the Philadelphia Fed and the New York regional numbers, and finishing Friday, we will get the conference board's leading indicators. So a big week on the economic front next week, as well as earnings season is beginning to wind down, and the catalyst will likely come from those economic readings, as well as some technical signals. So the big catalyst this week were the Fed Chair Powell's speech following a hot jobs report last week, Biden's State of the Union address, Russia's oil production cuts, and the fight over AI dominance in technology. And finally, those economic data points that are helping to lift up those long-term rates I mentioned. Up next, this week's guest technician, Tom McClellan.
When you're getting your headlines that are throwing you all kinds of data prints, some bullish, some bearish, ultimately, you, as an investor, you need a filter for that. So for us, we're focusing primarily on leading data. The unemployment rate is one of the most lagging series in the world. So it's always at its lowest just before a recession hits. And it typically peaks after the recession ends. So it's actually a good contrarian indicator in that sense. And similarly with things like non-farm payrolls, 500K jobs added in January is crazy high number. Digging into the history of non-farm payrolls, what we found is actually that these data points can be revised more than 10 times, right? So in the initial release you're getting can be actually very optimistic heading into a recession. And then after a year or so, the BLS can look back at those NFP numbers and they essentially revise it down. That's what we saw in 2007. We've seen that in prior recessions as well. And so I think people tend to forget that a lot of the labor market data particularly can be heavily revised and is misleading in real time.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Tom McClellan, editor of the McClellan Market Report at mcoscillator.com, joins us today. And Tom, I'm really happy to be speaking with you because I know when we spoke with you late last year, you had forecasted that we would see a powerful January rally, that would get all the bulls bulled up and everyone would be talking about a new bull market, but then that would basically be the peak. And then at that point, you were expecting that investors want to fade that rally. Obviously, we have seen a big January rally. And at one point, the NASDAQ was up over 15%. I know the S&P 500 was also up very strongly. So where do things stand today?
I wish I had better news for you. January rally was right on schedule. And it did affect the NASDAQ a whole lot more than the Dow Jones Industrials, for example, mostly because the NASDAQ was a lot more oversold. And a study I did years ago looks at, you know, if you have an oversold condition in an upturn, do you want to buy the market leaders or do you want to buy the ones that have been beaten down the most? Which is a good question. Normally, you think if you want to own the leaders, you want to own the relative strength leaders that are leading the way. But coming out of an oversold low, you want to buy the damaged property that's been beaten up the most because it has much more room to bounce back just due to the elastic effect. And that was the NASDAQ in January. Well, that bounce is accomplished. And now the higher beta stocks in the NASDAQ are probably going to be leading the way lower. That's the thing about beta is it leads the way upward and it leads the way downward. And you get more performance. Let's use that word as a double-edged sword. You can get more upward performance and more downward performance from the high beta stocks. The key issue is liquidity. And most of the time we look to breadth indicators to tell us about liquidity. And I'm talking about advanced decline statistics, up and down volume, new highs, new lows, number of stocks above some moving average, whatever way you want to measure that. And we've had gobs of strong breadth, which is normally a sign of a strong market and lots of liquidity. I think it's different this time. And I think that the big surge in January was because of a significant ripple in the way that money flows through the banking system. And I'm not talking about the Federal Reserve. I'm talking about the overall banking system. And that's one of the things that we watched was some proprietary indicators that we have. And the Fed is still doing QT. And that's going to matter at some point, but it can stop mattering for a little while and we can get a rally like January's. And now we're back into a depressing mode and lasting probably until early April.
Okay. So at this point, you see the strong rally that we've seen over the course of January, carrying a little bit into this month as well, that's going to start weakening now into April. Now, if we look at the, like you said, the tech sector, which is the higher beta space that saw most of the weakness through 2022 with the bear market, and then obviously the strong either short squeeze or momentum rally off of those lows. I mean, a number of these big tech names are weakening, again, pretty strongly. I mean, I'm looking at Google as well as Amazon and a number of these other names. So it sounds like if these areas, which were the leaders, if they continue to weaken from here, that's probably going to be dragging down the major market indices.
Yeah, well, they're still the leaders. They're just leading us in a new direction, and it's going to be downward for a while. And the key is that when it comes to the overall stock market, there are really only two fundamentals that matter. The first one is how much money is there? And the second is how much does that money want to be invested? And I'm talking about the money's motivation. You or I might be significantly motivated to buy the market and to bid it up, but how much money we have governs how much power we have to do that. And so you want to look at the motivation of the money. And when you change the amount of money or the motivation of the money, then you change the level of the stock market. Well, January was all about not so much creation of new money, because the Fed is still doing quantitative tightening. They're still selling off their balance sheet. They're still reducing liquidity available to the banking system. But that money can go through episodes where it really wants to get more invested, like we saw in January. Well, now that fuel of that motivational surge, that sentiment surge, that fuel has run out and it's not being backed up by new money courtesy of the Fed. And even though we're in a strong seasonal period, the Fed matters more, and it's going to matter in terms of bringing a decline, not a straight down, not a 1987 crash, not linear straight down, but a bumping, discouraging, grinding, awful, make you feel bad kind of decline. And until early April, probably the first week of April, there should be a preliminary bottom the 9th to the 14th of March, setting up the final bottom in early April. So I would say that mid-March is the bottom to go down into, and early April is the bottom to go up out of. Those two things don't have to be the same thing. Some, it doesn't have to be looking like a V. Sometimes it can be looking like a U. But it's going to. We need to do some discouraging everybody who rushed in January and got all excited about their tech stocks again. And that process of discouragement just takes a while.
Yeah, and as we've discussed with you in the past, the most likely scenario that we're looking at for this year and perhaps even longer is a sideways kind of trendless market, up and down, lots of volatility, not just a clear bullish trend or bearish trend. So it sounds like that's still the message that you're sticking to.
It is. And that should last all the way until September. The April bottom that I'm talking about, that's a nice trading bottom, but that's not the final bottom for this year. We're in the third year of a presidential term, and nearly always the third year is an up year. And this one may be also, but not right now. It's probably going to do all its gaining after a low due in late September that shows up on a lot of our predictive work. Independent things, not all the same thing, but several independent indications looking for September as being an important bottom. And then we get a great last 3 months of the year. But don't buy now in February to try to take advantage of a great last 3 months of the year. You'll have a better opportunity somewhere along the way and a lot of time to get everybody discouraged and hating the stock market and looking into other avenues for their life other than the stock market. And once that's done, once the market really thoroughly frustrates everybody, then we can get a nice bottom to go up out of. But we're not there yet.
You know, it's interesting, Tom, and this we saw really throughout most of last month was the tech sector shedding all these jobs, announcing mass layoffs here and there. And, you know, it's also late last year as well, of course, but Wall Street rewarding all of these companies, you know, saying, oh, we're going to lay off thousands of people. And then the stock price would just jump up. And now all that bullish momentum that was sucked into those stocks after those announcements, it's basically reversed. And we've seen the same thing with Disney, too. You know, Disney just announcing this week that it was going to lay off 7,000 employees. The stock initially jumped up pretty large, and now it's just reversed all of those gains.
Pretty fascinating, especially to see that in Disney. Wall Street likes layoffs because that means that the companies are going to save money on labor, but the economy doesn't like layoffs because all those now unemployed people are going to come out to the workforce and look for another job, and they're not going to be buying new BMWs, and they're not going to be getting into bidding wars on condos. And so that has a ripple effect on the economy. And so there's a difference between what it means for one stock if a company announces a 5% workforce reduction versus what it means for the economy. We are in a wave now that hasn't shown up yet in the lagging employment statistics. We're in a wave of rising unemployment that is just now going to be getting starting. And the reason for that is that unemployment lags changes in the inflation rate by about 2 years. People who are caught classical economics learn about the Phillips curve, which is an incorrect hypothesis that holds that unemployment and inflation are bound together in real time in a coincident way. And that's just the wrong hypothesis. It's a wrong understanding of the physics of how it works. Unemployment will change in a way that matches the footsteps of the inflation rate, but with a two-year lag time. And so the inflation rate started upward in March of 2021. So now we're at the two-year anniversary of that coming up on March 2023, when we should ideally see an upturn in the unemployment rate. And it may start a month or two earlier than that. We haven't got the March numbers, obviously, because it's still only February. But that's when it's ideally perfectly due if the two-year lag time works perfectly. And it doesn't usually work perfectly. There's a little bit of slop in the way that it works. But yeah, for the rest of this year, I would look for rising unemployment rates and discouraging jobs numbers generally. The Federal Reserve thinks it's going to keep raising short-term interest rates, and they are firm in their commitment of thinking that. I think that by about July, they're going to realize, oh, shoot, that's not what we're doing. One of the indicators that I sent a chart for looks at what the future is for short-term interest rates. And it looks at some really obscure data that almost nobody pays attention to. It's data in the Weekly Commitment of Traders report published by the CFTC. And it's data on a futures contract called the euro dollar, which is not the euro versus the dollar currency. It's a interest rate product referring to dollar denominated time deposits in European banks. And the commercial traders' net position in euro dollar futures gives us about a 10-month leading indication for what short-term interest rates are going to do. And that says short-term interest rates, such as the three-month T-bill that I use in the chart I sent you, that's due to peak out ideally in July of 2023. So the Fed might think that it's going to keep raising short-term rates, but the banking system often knows better than the Fed knows. And it's saying short-term rates are due to peak out in July and turn down later this year in a dramatic way. And usually the way that that happens is that unemployment rates start to rise in a meaningful way, forcing the Fed to realize, oh, shoot, we better not continue administering medicine to the patient because the medicine's starting to hurt too much. And that's what I see for this year. And the Fed's going to take a long time to realize that the message of the market. They've got several hundred PhDs working for them who all think that they know better than what the bond market knows and what the other economic conditions are. And so that they are going to take a long time to get convinced that they really need to change their thinking and start to back off on the medicine that they're applying to the market. They should back off now, but they won't. It'll take them a while to get to that point of realization.
So if you look at the Eurodollar chart that you shared and that we'll post along where this interview's on Financial Sense, that, in addition to, it sounds like the 2-year, are pointing to basically the Fed is going to be hitting some headwinds here, economically speaking, in the months ahead, it sounds like.
Yes, and they don't think that they are, but the bond market knows things that the PhDs don't know. The 2-year T-note yield is the best guide for what the Fed should do with short-term interest rates. In fact, I've been talking about this since 2011. A lot more people are taking up the issue that realize that, hey, the 2-year note yield knows better than the Federal Reserve officials know about what they're going to do. And if they want to do better monetary policy, they should just stop having FOMC meetings and they should outsource the setting of short-term interest rates to the 2-year T-note yield. What we've seen is that the Federal Reserve thinks they know better, and they've already hiked another quarter point at the last meeting on February 1st. They've gone beyond where the 2-year note yield has gone. And when they do that, that causes great problems. They did that back in end of 2000, and it helped really exacerbate the severity of the dot-com crash in 2001. They did it in 2006 and 7. They went beyond what the 2-year note yield had done, and that exacerbated how much of a great financial crisis we had. If they would just listen and tighten when they're supposed to and ease when they're supposed to, according to the 2-year note yield, they would do a lot less of building bubbles and then having them crash down. But they think they know better. So eventually they're going to find out. And the 2-year note is telling us that they've already gone farther than they should. But we just have to wait around for them to come to realize it.
So it sounds like, given what you just said, if the Fed does stay in this hawkish posture and continue raising rates at this point as the 2-year note is rolling over and the Eurodollar futures market, Eurodollar's market is also rolling over, then in that case, we could be setting up for a situation similar to something like what we saw during the tech bubble or even with the housing bubble. I mean, at least these are the two periods that you're drawing attention to with these charts.
And they're good periods for a historical example to show what can happen when the Fed goes too far. That doesn't mean that it has to happen exactly the same way this way. We're talking about the levers of economic power that the Fed has at its disposal. And you know, just like in your car, if you press the brakes too much or if you press the gas too much, you do adverse things to the acceleration and the positioning of the car. And the Fed typically screws it up in some way. They can screw it up more or they can screw it up less. And my hope is that they would someday learn so that they could screw it up less. But we can count on them screwing it up some way because they've just demonstrated such a great ability to do that over time. And what it's setting up to look like in 2023 is that they're going to over-tighten. And then the question is, how quickly can they realize that they've over-tightened and undo that before it creates a much bigger problem? And that's the unresolved question. And that's a question that the charts won't tell us, because that's asking a question about what's in the hearts of 12 people that sit around the table in the Mariner Eccles building and get to vote on those things. And the Fed, if the Fed suddenly got smart and started doing everything exactly what they should do, that's not going to change the existence of that April low that I was talking about. That's already cooked in. That's not something they can change, nor is it going to change the late September low that's also cooked in and is going to happen. What they can change is the amplitude or the magnitude of how bad things are as we put in that work. That's what they have their power to change. And it's an open question as to whether they will. And it really doesn't make that much difference for us as stock market investors to know exactly how bad of a decline it's going to be, because if it's a 10% decline or a 30% decline, which neither of which I'm predicting, you still want to take the same action. You want to avoid that. And so what matters more is getting the timing right. And if you get the timing of the turns correct and the direction of the trend, then the magnitudes will take care of themselves.
Now, Tom, one thing that's being often pointed to by the bulls right here is this golden cross where the shorter term 50-day moving average has moved above the longer term 200-day moving average. That's been, as far as I can tell, a decent indicator to show that the trend is shifting. What is your take on the golden cross?
I'm just about to be putting an article out on my website, so in another day you can see it. If you go to mcoscillator.com, I'll be writing about the golden cross. It is decent as a long-term tool. However, in the short term, it does some really interesting things. You're talking about the S&P 500, which has just completed its supposedly golden cross. The Dow Jones Industrial Average did that back in December. How prices are behaving at the moment of that cross tells us what's coming next. And quite often what we see is if you have an accelerated move like what we just had in January in the S&P 500, and if that's what brings about the golden cross, and you see a price well above the level of both of those moving averages at the moment of the cross, then what usually happens is that the moment of the crossing marks a short-term reversal point, in this case, a top for stocks, and prices will pull back. If what you see instead is a pullback in the prices, either upward or down, toward that price time point of where the two moving averages are crossing, what usually happens is a resumption of the trend that existed prior to that pullback. It's a unique bit of stock market physics. I don't have a good explanation for why it works that way. I've just seen it working that way for many years. And it's not just with the 50 and 200. We look at that a lot with 19 and 39 day exponential moving averages of prices, what we call the 10% trend and the 5% trend. And the same principle of when you get a moving average crossing, how prices are behaving at that moment gives you information about what's coming next. So the fact that we got a golden cross in the S&P 500 can be interpreted as an imperfect long-term bullish signal, while at the same time marking a likely temporary reversal point, or maybe more than a temporary one, because there are some bad signals. So it doesn't get me excited at all about trying to get long the market now just because we have a golden cross in the S&P 500. In fact, the way that it formed gives the opposite message. And that's definitely outside of the normal schooling viewpoint, but that's something that a few thousand hours of staring at charts has helped me to realize.
Well, I definitely encourage our listeners to go to mcoscillator.com and read that article, because obviously this is something you need to be paying attention to, since a lot of headlines are talking about this and seeing a lot of tweets about Golden Cross being so bullish for the market. So you're basically saying, hold on there. Well, Tom, before we go, you do have one other chart that you sent me that I do think we need to get in here, and that's a chart of gold. What is this telling you?
Well, and the chart I sent you of gold shows its price oscillator. It's an indicator my parents created back in 1969, the same time they created the McClellan Advanced Decline Oscillator that is more famous. The McClellan price oscillator uses the same 10% trend and 5% trend of closing prices. And the difference between those two moving averages is what's known as a price oscillator. So another way of doing MACD, although they created it several years before Gerald Appel created it and called it MACD. And so the difference between those two moving averages creates the indicator you see in that chart. The price oscillator got up to a very high level, and then importantly, it turned down while at that very high level. When you see that happen in gold's chart, and there's a couple of prior examples in there, you typically get a decline that lasts for a while, lasts until the price oscillator can work its way back down close to zero or even go down below it. So we've got a decline ahead of us in gold that should take a while. We saw a big one-day drop of more than 50 points on Friday, the 3rd of February. And the important thing about that is that in the nature of the way gold prices behave, you almost never see the bottom of a decline come on a big single down day. You will see that in the stock market. The stock market will crash and get all the way done in one day, but gold behaves differently. Gold tends to make spike tops and rounded bottoms, whereas the stock market makes spike bottoms and rounded tops. The stock market looks like the path of a bouncing tennis ball. The gold market price action on a chart looks like the opposite, where the tops are spiky and the bottoms are rounded. So where you see a big rapid drop like we saw on February 3rd, you know that that's almost never the last, the end point of the decline, that there's probably going to be much more to come. We'll have a longer grinding decline until we get lots of little declines to put in the final bottom, which is in the months ahead of us.
So again, we're looking at it most likely, according to your view, another couple months of pressure on the markets. Looking out more longer term, you expect that, you know, we're going to be looking at a volatile sideways trading market. It's going to be difficult for buy and hold passive investors, but probably more for active traders. You do see some continued pressure on the gold market, given this oscillator that you pointed to. And again, we'll have charts of a number of these things that we discussed today. Any high conviction calls or setups that you do see at this juncture that we didn't discuss already?
Not high conviction other than shorting the market right now. Here we are in February of 2023. High conviction about a bottom for an investable bottom, not just a trading bottom, but of an investing bottom September of 2023, taking the market up into about mid-2024, and then high conviction about a really awful, I'd call it a crash, in late 2024. The stock market is going to do horribly in late 2024, which means that whoever runs as a Democrat candidate is going to have no chance of winning the presidential election then, just because of what I see the stock market doing, and irrespective of the nature of that candidate or the nature of whoever's running against them, because the investing public doesn't like whoever's in power when there's a bear market, and there's going to be a big one in late 2024.
Well, as always, we look forward to speak with you in the months ahead to talk about how these things are playing out. As we close, would you mind telling our listeners the best way that they can follow more of your work, Tom?
You already mentioned our website, mcoscillator.com. That's a contraction of the word McClellan Oscillator, the indicator that my parents developed back in 1969. We have a twice-monthly newsletter, the McClellan Market Report. We have a daily edition for those who want information every day. We also have a big free learning center at our website. Lots of free articles you can look at to get familiar with the indicators that we use and the way we like to analyze the market. You can sign up for our free weekly chart and focus email. It's a single article about a single indicator or chart, and it goes out every week. If you give us your email address, we'll be happy to send that to you. We don't ever sell our email list. You won't ever get spam as a result of signing up for that. It's just a way to get more people acquainted with the work that we do.
Well, Tom, it was a pleasure to speak with you again on Financial Sense NewsHour. Keep up the great work, and we look forward to having a conversation with you in the future.
Like last time I was on, I think I'm a bit more cautious than the consensus. I'll admit that there has been some positive improvement since the lows of 3,600. There have been some signs of progress in China reopening. The economy is proving to be more resilient than expected. So, you know, a lot of the sort of the very negative calls have so far been at least delayed. That said, the economy is still slowing. And unless the bond market is absolutely fantastically wrong, really for the first time in my career, and I think pretty much everybody's career on Wall Street, then this economy is headed for a recession. It may not start for 9 months. It may not start for a year, but it's still headed that way.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939. Or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, will this be another good year for commodities? We saw oil prices hit over $100 a barrel. Will they be back up there again? And what about other commodities, base metals, copper, silver, gold? Joining us on the program from Bloomberg Markets is Mike McGlone. And Mark, let's begin with probably taking a look at the oil markets. OPEC is still holding to its production cuts, even though there's speculation with China's economy coming back online out of COVID, that demand for energy will increase, pushing up oil prices. Your view?
No, I'm bearish. And that's one thing I like, Jim, about my position here in Bloomberg Intelligence. I have my views and I just like to express them. And I'm not going to give you a one-handed economist like Harry Truman desired. So I like to say, let's start with what's happening with the benchmark for the world's, for U.S. energy. So not just energy, for heat and electricity production, that's natural gas. The U.S. natural gas benchmark at $2.54 per million MMBTU has dropped to the same price that first was traded in 1990. That's 33 years ago. That's significant deflation on the back of rapidly advancing technology and the elasticity of supply and demand on the back of a big price pump from last year. That's what commodities typically do. They spike and they very rarely stay up. So I think crude oil is going that way. We are heading towards a recession. The Fed Reserve, the ECB, and the Bank of England all tightened rates last week. That is not an environment for a soft landing and for commodities to rally. And I just point out facts of history, too. So I view WTI crude oil currently, it's, you know, we're going to be publishing this on Friday, currently around $76 a barrel. The peak last year was 130. The peak in 2008, which was the all-time high, was 145. That's the bear market resuming. So I think in a typical recessionary environment, WTI crude oil is more likely to head towards the cost of production, which natural gas almost pretty closely has done already, around $2, between $2.50 in natural gas. I think WTI crude oil is more likely to head towards 40. And I have to point out one thing I've learned in my lesson in trading, investing, and managing commodity indices is be careful of widely watched narratives from bulls who think prices are going to go up. And this key thing I want to point out about WTI crude oil, the price you see in that screen around $76 was first traded in 2006. So what I see what happened in crude oil last year was a spike. That spike was pretty significant on a two-year basis. And our data going back to 1899 was the highest velocity spike ever. It was got to around 400%. Yes, it got very low. But every single time we've had a spike of anywhere near that velocity, we've had a recession in the U.S., and I think that's the key thing the market's looking forward to. The key thing I'll point out is, remember, don't fight the Fed. The fact that we said that a year ago, the Fed is still tightening and is still worried about strong labor, I think expect commodities to do what they almost always do. They have periods of moribund prices, almost always after spikes like we had last year.
And speaking of oil, let's talk about what's going on with oil companies. We've seen huge major buybacks. BP blew away their earnings today, increased the dividend 10%. You had Chevron buying back $75 billion in stock, Exxon buying back $50 billion. So I assume when they're announcing these buybacks, they're looking at what their cash flow is going to be before you would make an announcement like that.
Yes. Yeah, so that's one big difference between the actual underlying commodity and companies that benefit from producing those commodities and producing more of them at lesser costs on basically a daily basis. The energy equities are some of the best performers. I fully expect that to continue to happen. Yes, not at the pace of last year. And you look at historically, you look at things like XLE, the ETF that's widely tracked, most widely attracted. It was almost always has been outperforming the Bloomberg Energy Index, which is based on the own rolling the futures in the commodities or in the spot prices. And the key thing that I think I need to point out there is, yes, they are not increasing production at the pace that most people have expected. But remember, those are the publicly traded companies. A lot of these, there's a hundred or hundreds of independent energy companies in the world, most notably in this country, that, you know, they simply don't miss the facts of Adam Smith and the invisible hand. When prices go up that much and they can make that much money, that supply will come on. But that's not so significant now. Supply was the story last year. Now it's demand destruction. Demand in the U.S. actually is peaked in 2005. It got bumped up again around 2018. But if you look at one thing I was pointing out last year in June, unleaded gas demand in this country started rolling over and has been dropping, still is dropping at a higher velocity than it did in 2008 before the big collapse. So I like to point out energy companies are a different story from the underlying commodities. And here's a fact of history is the Malthusians have always pointed out that population is growing too fast for commodity growth, have been wrong for about 300 years. And it's the fact I like to point out is people are smart, commodities aren't. So the energy companies actually do well. Now, as far as the buybacks and things, that's their prerogative. This is a capitalist system. A lot of those companies are in pension funds, endowments, sovereign wealth funds, and so on and so forth, part of our investments. And there's a lot of entities out there that benefit from them and need that diversification in their portfolio. So I look at it as let free markets reign and allow them to do like every other company what they want to maximize profits in a capitalist system.
I want to talk about an article you recently wrote. What beats gold if a recession in the Fed pivots? Likely not much. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So one of my major biases this year is I fully expect crude oil commodities are continuing to decline. At some point, the Fed is going to have to pivot. They always do. We know they can't keep tightening like this forever. I fully expect we're going to have a pretty severe recession. That's just based on historical trends and the fact is they're still tightening. And at some point when they do pivot, I see gold as one of the primary assets that should do well in this environment. Gold and U.S. Treasury long bonds. Now, like most assets, they were beat up last year. And like most assets, they've recovered this year. But in an enduring normal cyclical market where I see the U.S. tilting towards recession, the Fed easing, and the market going in the whole world going back to a significant deflationary period, and that's not profound. It's against consensus. All these people expect inflation out of the biggest dump in liquidity. I don't see where that's coming from. But what I see happening is we're going back to a significant deflationary period on the back of all the tightening and gold to be one of the better performers. And what I did is I compared gold, and I've been doing this forever, against most other assets, the stock market, crude oil, silver, bond market, and I see gold coming out ahead. Still, it's also, you look at enduring trends. Gold has had a pretty good long upward trend since 2000. Now, it backed off since 2011 or so. But during that period, we had a significant rally in the equity market. So what I see is a normal recession, the equity market having a typical 50% correction, which it had. It did in 2000. It did in 2008. It dropped about 30% when we had the first of COVID. A normal 50% correction, which means it's about halfway through, actually a little less, and gold coming out ahead as we trigger towards deflationary recession, the Fed having to pivot, and gold being the store value that benefits. The one thing I'll point out is gold did make a new high in terms of the euro and the yen, the major currencies in the world last year and recently. And typically, that's a sign it's going to do it in the dollar. So we're speaking dollar basis. The way I see gold is it's an enduring bull market that had a bit of a blip, a correction. It's bouncing up against $2,000 resistance. It's kind of like we would call that a triple top in technical analysis. I think it's a matter of time. It just breaks through. Once we get to that pivot from the Fed, now the Fed says they're not going to ease, but the market's priced for that ease in starting later in the year. And I think what will happen is my base case is we get to the recession, stock market starts declining, gold and long bonds are one of the best performers. I'll end with this. Part of that outlook for gold comes from what I expect from crude oil. And that's done what I expect last year. It spiked a little bit more than I thought, but now it's going back to an enduring bear market. Crude oil has been a bear market since the peak 2008. It peaked a little bit lower last year. It's heading lower now as we head towards recession. And we are finding out that demand is just not there and supply comes on more organically on a global basis from the rules of Adam Smith. And there's so many places in the world that can bring on crude oil. And that's one thing about this country is people say there's not investment. Why come from Illinois? We had a farm and a lot of the corn we planted goes for ethanol. And we're just more and more energy we can create from other sources, typically biofuels.
Where do you see base metals in this environment, especially with the global push towards green energy?
Yeah, so that's one of my best places, I think, to invest in commodities is I always go to the metals. So a couple of years ago, I encouraged our index team to launch the Bloomberg's All Metals Index. And metals, number one, I fully expect will come out of this transition in the global economy towards replacing energy with technology. And also one thing the metals have going for them, the underlying metals don't have those issues of storage. It's usually much cheaper to store them. So it's not going to cost you in the roll in futures and things like that. And then you have precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and then copper and aluminum. In this economy that's really kicking in towards electrification and decarbonization, that's where I expect the returns to continue. Now, I pointed out historically, the metals, if you use a total return index, a metals index, Bloomberg All Metals Total Index, basically outperforms most commodities along with the energies, outperforms agriculture, and outperforms broad commodities. And also, it outperforms mostly, notably, a lot of equities. That's a unique thing. You look at things like GDX or the XME, the ETFs that track the metals producers, the actual metals indices that track the underlying indices typically outperform. So I'm sticking with the metals, my long-term outlook. Gold's in there, silver, platinum, palladium, you know, whatever you want to do with copper and aluminum. One thing that was significant last year is copper did make an all-time new high last year. Crude oil didn't. I think that's telling what we should expect in the future. Crude oil continues to succumb to technology replacing it. A lot of that technology means demand for copper. And then we also know copper sometimes does have some dicey sources from South America. So very bullish that's case. But in the short term, no. I think copper around eight, it's trading around $9,000 a ton is more likely to trade down to seven in a recessionary environment, but then come out ahead. So I think the key thing right now is we're heading towards this recession. And I think I'm less consensus. I just said this over a year ago. I think it's just more severe now because the Fed is still raising rates. But the key thing I like to warn investors about is this hopium that Chinese demand is going to make a big difference in this whole space. I've been pointing out incremental declining demand from China for many years. But overall, I think the metals are the place to be. Just not yet. We have to get through this recession. So I think it's going to be a while.
You know, and speaking of recession, there's this hope, I guess, on Wall Street with a pivot coming soon from the Fed, and it's going to be a soft landing. I've seen only maybe one or two soft landings in my career coming from the Fed. Usually, most of the time, they crash the airplane.
Exactly. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because I view that as a complete oxymoron. Now, I came to New York in 93 and I was a treasury trader. So I remember that tightening cycle in 1994 very well. And it turned out very well for basically that was to me the quintessential soft landing. But it's an entirely different world now. We have 100-year events converging. Number one, we have the Fed still tightening. And the lesson in commodities is it typically basically takes for that deflationary, obviously, you know, long and variable lags from the Fed. And it was a year ago, the Fed funds rate was still zero. And now it's almost five. So let's just say it's going to take a while. So to me, this is going to be one of the most significant global macroeconomic resets in our lifetime. So look at the foundation for what happened. Number one, we had this cheerleader and chief president boosted up the stock market. Then, of course, we had the plague and the massive liquidity pump and then the biggest dump in history. Then we had this war, which also created this biggest pump in crude oil ever on a two-year basis. And now it's dumping. To me, the whole world is heading that way. And I think it's global. We saw what's happened in Europe. People think just because the weather got better, it's not going to be a bad recession. But have you seen the mortgage resets? I mean, it's obviously the crude oil, the energy issue is a problem. So to me, this is way overdue. This is going to be a normal, typical recession like we had in 2000, 2002, like we had in 2008 and 2009, which means 50% correction in the stock market. That's just normal in the S&P 500. We're nowhere near that. And I also have to caution investors, this time of year is a time for hopium and, you know, resolutions. It's the worst time, I think, to get bullish when you see the Fed still tightening. So I don't see it. And also then you point out things like housing. One thing I like to point out in housing is you look at new homes under construction, it's just rolling over from the highest level ever. So that inventory is just kicking over. Now, we saw this cycle back in 2006 to 2011. That was the last big housing crisis. I think it's going to be worse. And you see what's happened with interest rates. I mean, the average rate a year ago, you can buy maybe a little bit more. You can buy a home for 3% mortgage. Now you're lucky if you're in 6, almost 7% handle for a mortgage. And to me, this is the big one. And the key fact is typically it takes pretty aggressive Fed easing and it takes time. So I would say after we have the first ease, maybe everything will settle down and bottom within a year and a half. And guess what? In commodities, it typically takes over a year for commodity market at the bottom after the first ease. As far as I know, looking at the Bloomberg, the Fed is still supposed to be tightening. I think here's the key juxtaposition. Based on what Chairman Powell says, which I agree with, he will not be easing anytime soon, which he said in the last meeting. They will not be easing until the markets force them, which means lower asset prices, which means we have to make it difficult for people to buy stuff.
And what are the chances they keep raising that we get some kind of credit event? Usually when the Fed does that, somebody blows up, a hedge fund, a company, you're seeing more bankruptcies. What about a credit event?
There you go. I mean, I think that's one thing I really appreciate about doing podcasts with you, Jimmy. You can tell your wisdom and experiences. I view it as these things are just part of the noise of markets. So we're having this stuff in the fastest market in the space in cryptos. You're seeing the tide going out, who's wearing clothes. These things only happen in bear markets. Why? Because you have to take the tide out and see who's over leveraged and just doing irresponsible things with their money and other money. So as far as credit event, I think that's one problem right now. Credit spreads are too narrow in a typical recession. They get much wider than they are. As far as predicting the events, sometimes that can make the low. But the sense I really fear right now is people think the bottom's in. Did you not notice what the Fed is still tightening and the economy is still rolling over? And yes, there's a few good signs, but there always is. And the problem I view about this, Jim, is they are tightening based on a significant lagging indicator, which is becoming less relevant. You know, that's wonderful. People need to be worked. That's a great to work. That's a great thing. But you look at a lot of the leading indicators, obviously the curve is one of them. This is going to be a pretty bad one. And I think when the tide goes out, we get, you know, take out that low. I think that's what we have to do. We have to make a new low. We have to make people very fearful. And bear markets never come with simple little corrections. Like, I mean, good and during bull markets, I would say. So I think what we're going to have to do is take out the low from last year, have a sustainable bearish period where it takes, I remember you and I had seen these lower Morbin pairs, where it takes 3 to 5 years before stock markets recover. And in those environments, when markets go down, we have those events, just part of the noise of markets, but to me, it's the macros, prices that matter. And I like to point out this stuff has already happened in cryptos to some extent. And that's why I'm kind of bearish that space and bearish commodities and bullish long bonds and gold.
All right. Well, on that note, Mike, if our listeners like to follow the work that you do, you put out a lot of good stuff. How could they do so?
Well, thank you, Jim. I post on LinkedIn. You can just find me, Mike McGlone. I'm at Bloomberg and happy to add you to my distribution list. Just reach out, link in with me. And I'm also on Twitter, Mike McGlone 11. And on your show, and I really appreciate your cooperation, our interviews, and I learn a lot from the stuff you post too. So thank you.
You bet. Well, listen, all the best to you, and we'll talk to you again.
Today, we're going to discuss the macro backdrop when it comes to the economy, corporate profits, and monetary policy, all of which are continuing to exert pressure on the outlook for the stock market. Welcome, everyone, to our Smart Macro Edition on Financial Sense NewsHour. Our guest today is Chris Poplava, our CIO at Financial Sense Wealth Management, who has the equivalent of NASA's Mission Control Center at his office behind a wall of monitors. And Chris, it's always a pleasure to discuss what's going on and get your view about what's happening in the markets. Let's dive into some of the key points that you raised in this week's investment meeting we posted on our site and on YouTube, where you did a deep dive into the surprising strong jobs report last week, which came in well above everyone's expectations. And that has pushed more on Wall Street towards the view that we'll either see a soft landing, that is no recession at all, or possibly even no landing. That is, it's up and away for the economy from here. What is your take on all of this?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at the details of the jobs report, Chris, I mean, it absolutely was a blowout. I mean, it you know, took everyone by surprise. And in our weekly investment meeting, one of the things we highlighted or I showed was there was, you know, at least according to Bloomberg, there were 78 estimates that they collected. And of those 78, no one even came close. I mean, the highest estimate was for 320,000. And then obviously we got 517. So it was a massive, massive blowout. And at first blush, that would make it seem like, you know, the economy is doing fine. Everything looks good. But when you go beneath the surface, there's a lot to be desired. For example, the highest area adding jobs were in lower paying service jobs. And what was concerning to me, Chris, was when you look at the 55 and over, that age group lost 162,000. And the reason why that's a concern is the older you get, you're further along in your career, you're more established, you've had some promotions, pay raises. And so typically the older you are, the more money you're earning. And so those are the people with the highest spending power because their incomes are the highest. And when you see job losses there, that could definitely mean a major hit to the economy. Usually those who are making minimum wage are kind of living paycheck to paycheck. So they don't really have a lot of excess discretionary spending. A lot of the discretionary excess spending comes from the older demographic. So seeing 162,000 jobs lost in the 55 and older is definitely cause for concern. And again, as I mentioned, when you're older, you're typically further in your career. Maybe you've gone back to get a master's or even some higher level of education. And when we look at the education backdrop, what we found is those with a bachelor's degree or higher, we saw 356,000 jobs lost. Now, I'm sorry, you know, I know that the headline looked great, but you dig beneath the surface, seeing college graduates, seeing that demographic lose 356,000 jobs is not a cause for celebration. The bulk of the jobs were added with high school graduates with no college. So again, most likely these are minimum wage earners. And there we saw just under 500,000 in terms of total payrolls there. And then some college or associate's degree, we saw 311,000 jobs added. So again, the higher earner, higher educated population actually saw a pretty hefty job loss. So that's kind of where I was saying when you dig beneath the surface, there's a lot to be wanted.
Aaron Param at Variant Perception that we spoke with on this week's edition of FS Insider, he also pointed out that non-farm payrolls are heavily revised and that you can see up to 10 different revisions that take place after the initial release. And it could be, you know, a few revisions down the road that a very strong positive number ends up coming in a lot weaker than what's expected. And we also did see some revisions on the CPI data for late last year that were revised upward. So it looks like inflation may not be slowing as fast as thought, given some of those revisions that have been made. So that's one of the nuances and complexities or difficulties of looking at some of these official government statistics is the number of revisions that they go through. So you can't just look at the single number. But again, as you pointed out, I mean, the bulk of the payrolls came from lower paying services jobs in primarily leisure and hospitality, but the top earners, particularly in that 55 and older, saw net losses or firings. And really, there's a tale of two different cities here when you look at leisure and hospitality versus the information technology sector. So that's a real key theme that we've seen over the prior few months, too, is just a kind of post-COVID catch-up and mean reversion.
That's absolutely correct, Chris. So when we look at the leisure and hospitality industry, I mean, clearly they were one of the slowest to reopen. There's still a lot of concerns with COVID, even as the vaccines were rolled out and we had weaker and weaker variants of the virus. But when I look at the trend for leisure, hospitality, plus education and health service employment, we're looking, when you look at what the trend was pre-COVID, it would take another 3 million jobs to even get back to trend. So it kind of shows you there's still some more hiring that needs to take place there. And when we look at other areas, like, for example, information payrolls, there we're probably going to shed another 122,000 jobs just to get back to trend. And there's other areas like media, telecom, I'm sure, also saw excessive payrolls above trend. So that really kind of shows you really the kind of impact of COVID, where we had some excesses and then there's still a lot of rebuilding to go, particularly the leisure and hospitality. But, it wasn't just those areas that, you know, were seeing some noticeable trends take place. One of the things we're also starting to see is that more or less, Chris, full-time payrolls peaked last year in 22. We have yet to hit a new high in full-time employment, and that peak occurred roughly around the middle of 22. Now, that's a concern because you typically see full-time payrolls begin to decline just going into recession, but we don't see a decline yet. We're just not seeing any more growth. It's basically been stagnant. Where we have seen growth is in part-time payrolls. Those are surging, and that is often what we see going into recession. So, for example, the 2008 recession, we saw roughly, I would say, around 3 to 4 million part-time jobs added to total part-time payrolls, and we saw full-time employment plunge dramatically. So, the fact that we're seeing this surge right now is not an encouraging sign. So what it tells you is if full-time payrolls aren't moving, and yet part-time payrolls are, what's likely happening is we're seeing an equal number of people being hired full-time as those that are being essentially let go. And I think what we're seeing are some of those full-time employees seeing their hours cut to less than 35 hours. So they're kind of moving to part-time as the company that they're working for is trying to protect their profit margins and deal with weakening sales. So that's not an encouraging sign when you start to see part-time payrolls really begin to pick up. That's definitely a worrisome sign.
And I do want to point out that you show all these different charts comparing what we see today versus what we saw in prior cycles, particularly that 2008, 2009 period. So I'll post a link to that video so all of you can check that out if you haven't already. But again, just to summarize what we're discussing here, this big employment surge is still largely a reflection of trying to play catch up from what we saw during COVID. Obviously, there was a ton of people that were either laid off or sitting on the sidelines in the leisure and hospitality sector. As you said, we're still about 3 million jobs away from getting back to the pre-COVID trend. So, and that's what we saw in this last big jobs number, was a pickup there. However, the information technology sector is shedding jobs. We've been hearing all of these mass layoffs that have been happening, it seems like almost every week. And that's because we just saw so much hiring come into that sector. That sector, at least according to the jobs data that you showed in these charts, is still bloated by, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of jobs, if not millions of jobs. So there still has to be some downsizing there to get back to that underlying trend.
Not only are we seeing that, and we're seeing employers cut payrolls full-time and cut hours for workers. One of the other things we typically see heading into a downturn is you also let go of your easiest workers to let go, and those are temp employees. So these are employees that aren't really on your permanent payroll. You're not paying them any benefits. They're a lot easier to let go. And you're usually going to tend to kind of cut around the margin first in the easiest areas to cut. And these, because they're temporary, usually they're less experienced because they haven't been working for you a while. Again, they're temp. And so we often see employers cut temp payrolls first, then they cut hours, and then lastly, they actually cut their total payroll count. And just as an example, when we look at the total payrolls for temporary help services, those started to turn negative in early 2007, roughly about a year before the recession started. And when we look at the year-over-year rate of change for total payrolls, those really didn't turn negative until we were actually already in the recession. And when we look at where things stand currently, we're negative for payrolls for temp employment. We're down about 0.5% from year ago levels. So we're no longer growing. We could continue to fall quite steeply. We've been really falling off over the last several months here. So if we continue at this pace, we could really start to see some payrolls lost from temporary help workers. And that would not be an encouraging sign for full-time payrolls.
And again, that's a leading economic indicator that we follow in addition to a wide range of others to understand what is the underlying trend that we're looking at. Because again, this big jobs number could be heavily revised down the road, and a lot of this is noise. But this plays directly into what you discussed 2 weeks ago in a prior investment meeting video that we posted, where you talked about how the next move in the market is going to be related to yields.
Well, that's also a concern too, Chris, not just for the economy, but also the markets. So as interest rates continue to move higher, that's obviously going to be a negative for housing, which has already taken a very strong beating and is looking for some relief. We're not going to get that if interest rates for mortgage rates continue to move higher. Also for borrowing, if you're a small business or if you're a company that doesn't have access to, for example, the stock market, if you're not publicly traded, your greatest source of financing is going to come from the debt markets and from banks. And what we're finding there, Chris, is interest rates moving up would mean the borrowing cost for users would move up as well. So if you're a company and you're starting to see your sales begin to dwindle, the last thing you want is to pay higher interest payments. You'd want to see lower interest payments. So again, that's going to be negative for the economy. It's also going to be negative for the stock market, which is looking for the Fed to pivot and looking for rates to move down. When we saw rates peak in October of last year, a lot of people were looking at market rates for the U.S. moving lower is a sign that the market was basically betting that the Fed was getting close to being done and would likely start to cut rates in the back half of this year. One of the things that I was trying to highlight when I was looking at U.S. and foreign yields is you look at their trends, there's really no sign of a reversal yet. For example, one of the easiest ways to look at what the primary trend is the slope of the 200-day moving average, which is roughly a one-year moving average. And when we look across the board, whether you're looking at Europe, UK, Japan, or the US, they're still moving upwards. And one of the other things I pointed out in that video in late January was that the US 10-year yield remained in an uptrend, but it was consolidating after it peaked in October. But what I was looking at on the chart was it looked to me like it was forming a bullish wedge. And if it broke out of that, that would basically just say that we were stair-stepping since October. So, two steps forward, one step back, and we're ready to start moving forward again. And today, as we are speaking, Chris, on February 10th, we did get a breakout in the 10-year Treasury yield above that declining trend that's been in place since October. So that would tend to argue, if this trend continues, it's not a false move, that we do have a breakout in that bullish wedge formation. We could be seeing much significantly higher rates. Right now, the 10-year is about 3.74%, and it peaked just under 4.5% late last year. So a move north of 4% would not be a good sign for the markets. That would even further strengthen the idea that this was just a pause in a long-term uptrend that began in late 2020. And that would definitely be a negative for the market. The other thing I'm watching, Chris, is the US dollar. So what we've seen is that the S&P 500 and US stocks in general tend to trade inversely to the dollar as well as interest rates. So as interest rates were moving higher, so dollar was moving higher, that was tightening overall financial conditions and weakening stock prices. But what we saw with the bottom of the stock market in October was the peak in interest rates, and we also saw the peak in the US dollar. So we're already starting to see a potential breakout here, which would be confirmed with a further few days of higher moves in the 10-year treasury, is the US dollar, which has been capped below its 50-day moving average. If it breaks above that, that too, Chris, I think would be another nail in the coffin for this, basically what I've been saying is a bear market rally. I don't think the bear market's done. I just think sentiment got way overdone on the downside, that we were due for some kind of a relief rally, and it could potentially be over.
Well, let me read you a headline to tie this together back to the jobs report. This is Goldman's chief economist. He says that this report could have just changed the whole year for markets. And I think the idea here is that, you know, good news is bad, essentially. And when you get a number that's this good, at least on the surface, it means that the Fed is going to have to be tighter. That's what Fed Chair James Powell said as well, commenting on it, is that, you know, it shows that we still have quite a ways to go on inflation. So we've seen a lot of movements in the market around this number. Number one, this is now putting more pressure on the Fed to stay higher for longer. That is also now causing yields to move higher as well. And we're also seeing a higher move in the dollar in response. So there's a whole bunch of things that are related back to this jobs report. Because again, it was way, way above what anyone expected. But it's still this idea that good news is bad.
That's correct, Chris. And one of the other things I pointed out this week in the video was that, you know, overall, when I look at the economy from a, you know, big picture perspective, I see a economy that's decelerating, not one that's accelerating. And, you know, one jobs report doesn't change the trend. And as again, when I look beneath the surface, those trends are actually turning more and more negative. But another thing that we're noticing, and I think will really start to pick up, is the downward movement in S&P earnings. So basically, when we start to see the yield curve, which is a great predictor of recessions, invert, that tends to highlight essentially tightening financial conditions that could ultimately lead to a recession. Well, the yield curve also does a pretty good job of kind of capping the trends in S&P forward earnings per share. And the yield curve, when we advance it further, it basically argues that we should continue to see corporate earnings weaken throughout this year and heading into 2024, because the yield curve does tend to lead earnings growth for the S&P. And one of the things we showed, Chris, were a couple of charts of this where the market tends to struggle when forward earnings per share turn negative. We saw that in 2001. Part of the worst part of that decline in that bear market occurred when earnings were declining on an annual basis. And particularly when we look at the 2007 through 2009 bear market, the steepest part of the decline occurred in the back half of 2008. And that's when forward earnings per share for the S&P turned negative and then steeply declined to a 40% decline in an annual growth rate, which occurred in January of 2008. S&P earnings were down 40% from the prior level. So that's definitely a cause for concern when we look at the current case in which S&P earnings are just now turning negative for forward earnings per share. They're down about 3.6% from year-ago levels. So if these continue to head lower, at the same time we're dealing with higher interest rates and a stronger dollar, that would definitely be cause for concern for financial markets.
Okay, so as we discuss, you know, when we think about this blowout jobs number, under the surface, given the analysis that you conducted this week, it does appear that there is some trouble brewing. And this is consistent with data points that we've seen prior to other recessions as well. So Wall Street is reacting to this on the short term by believing that this is making the case for a soft landing or no landing at all. We're saying just the opposite, that the primary trend based on the leading economic indicators and a number of things that we track here at Financial Sense Wealth Management are still showing that the economy is going to continue slowing and that a recession is basically our base case scenario. In which case, what are we doing in portfolios here at Financial Sense Wealth Management? Again, when we discussed late 2021, you had turned very cautious and defensive on the market, saying that 2022 would be a bad year for stocks. We had raised a lot of cash at the end of 2021 when the market peaked and into the beginning of last year, and we've been mostly defensive at this point. Is that still the message?
That's still the message, Chris. One of the things that we saw in October with the October bottom is we felt we were overdue for a bear market rally and didn't quite know how far the market would rally or how long it would take place. But we are seeing obviously a pretty strong move off the October lows. And so one of the things we did is we moved from a maximum defense position almost back to a more of a neutral position for our portfolios for clients to basically participate on the upside with the idea that we would have an eye towards the exits when we felt like the rally was ending. Now, we obviously had a negative week this week, and we could start to see the market continue to weaken further, or we might have one last push higher. I know we've had Craig Johnson on the show, and he kind of was in that hop, a drop, and a pop camp, meaning we might have some more upside going into, let's say, March or later this month. So for us, what we're doing, Chris, is really taking a look at all of our positions, looking for those areas of strength and weakness. And for those areas of weakness, those are going to be our sell candidates to get us back towards a maximum defensive position. So that's what we're doing right now, Chris, is really keeping an eye on the exits. I feel we're a lot closer to the exits than we were several months ago. And our position remains that we feel this is just a bear market rally, that the bear market is not over, and that this is not the start of a new bull market, which is why we really only went back to neutral or slightly below that. And we didn't kind of go to a maximum allocation towards risk assets like stocks. So we remain still, Chris, defensive at this point.
Well, Chris, thanks again for coming on and speaking with us in this week's Smart Macro Edition. Again, we have Chris on every 2 weeks to get an update on his outlook. But if you want to be tracking all of his analysis, the charts that we're looking at in terms of what we're doing here at Financial Sense Wealth Management, when it comes to understanding the primary trend in the markets and the economy, we post our weekly investment meetings both on our site and on YouTube, so you can catch those weekly. Chris, thanks again for coming on and speaking with us, and we definitely look forward to speaking with you in another 2 weeks. That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.